Today's program has been brought to you by 360 Cookware, American-made, green-manufactured cookware using vapor technology. For more information, visit 360cookware.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, but we're down in Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's, and today I have a very special guest who's also a dean at the International Culinary Center, none other than Mr. Chocolat himself, Jacques Torres.
Bonjour, Dorothy.
Bonjour, Jacques. I think everyone in New York knows Jacques Torres, Mr. Chocolat, because his beautiful chocolate brown boxes with orange bows and shops from Dumbo to the Upper West Side. Everybody sort of goes to Jacques when they want that chocolate fix. But people might not know his background, that he's one of probably the most revered pastry chefs in the world. He was the youngest pastry chef to ever win what's called the MOF, the Meilleur Ouvrier de France, which is it's a special distinction. It's an exam given every 4 years, and only the top chefs compete. And at the end, they only pick a few to be the best craftsmen in France in that division. And when Jacques won it, he was the youngest. There's only a handful of these people, and his technique is second to none and first among many. And then he came to New York, and we'll go into that later, but many people know him because he was the 4-star award-winning pastry chef at Le Cirque during its heyday in the 80s and 90s, and worked with Daniel Boulou and Sota Kuhn and many people like that, many great chefs like that. And he also has been one of the few people who've won the Outstanding Pastry Chef Award from the James Beard Foundation. I mean, they only pick one every year in the country. He's won that accolade as well. So I am sitting in the sweetest seat in Brooklyn because he's brought all these wonderful goodies from a chocolate snowman to chocolate gingerbread men, and we're going to get right into it. Hello, Jacques.
Oui, Dorothy.
Oh, happy, and you're a teacher here too. You're a fantastic teacher. You demo at this school, and you wrote our pastry curriculum. But anyway, I want to really go on your extraordinary journey, because I know a lot of people out there, they love pastry, they love sweets, and they're good at it, you know, cooking at home. But what does it take to make a real pastry chef? And what was your journey? Where did you grow up? And how did you get to be the youngest MOF in France?
So let's start with where I grew up. I love that place. It's still in my heart, of course, and I go there every year. I grew up in the south of France, in a small city called Bandol, small town. 7,000 people live in Bandol, which is less than a medium-sized building in Manhattan. And Bandol can fit completely into Central Park. So it's a small little town.
On the Mediterranean.
On the Mediterranean, in between Toulon and Marseille. Little port. But Bandol is well known for its wine. Mm-hmm. A good rosé. Mm-hmm. And Domaine Tempier Red is delicious. I mean, mm-hmm. good wine. So I grew up there. And, you know, at the time that I grew there, we know the baker, we know the butcher, we know who do what. That was very obvious that even if the product was not luxurious product, there was premium product. And I think that's where I developed a taste for whatever is premium. I mean, there you get the melon, and the melon is good for today or for tomorrow. And that's how they sell them. They ask you, do you want to eat them tonight or tomorrow? I mean, it's amazing how people treat food there. They really love good food. So I grew up there, and my brother was a chef, a culinary chef. And I want to be a culinary chef, and I asked him his advice. And his advice was, it's no very good restaurant or very high-end restaurant in Bandol, but it's a very good pastry shop. So I went there, and I talked to the owner. I was 15, and I know I'm going to leave school at 16. And he told me, he said, look, come every weekend, come every Wednesday, whenever you have some time, come and work with us. And if you like it, and also if we like you, you can do an apprenticeship. You can enter a 2 years apprenticeship. So I did. I went every weekend, and I remember the first day. This gentleman asked me to come at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I think I never get up at 5 o'clock in the morning before that. So I was a little bit sleepy, and I walk into this world where, you know, you have those big fluorescent lights, and on the morning you don't have much noise except the radio on the background. And everybody is a little bit sleepy and walking, so you have those noise around you. And then you have the smell. When you take those dough out of the refrigerator, you have the fermentation that happened all night, and the fermentation of the croissant dough, of the brioche dough, and you smell that. And then you start to get dirty. You start to touch those sticky dough and make the croissant. And then at 6:30 in the morning, the first croissant come out of the oven. And that's magical. You just smell that beautiful caramelized buttery smell, and you want to eat croissant. And then after that, you know, we start to do all the pie, all the tarts, all the cakes. And to see those beautiful shiny pie and those beautiful strawberry, and I just fall in love with the profession. And that day, I was 15, the first time that I spent a morning into a pastry shop. That day, I say, that's it. I'm going to spend my life doing that.
My gosh. Wow. Un coup de feu?
Coup de foudre.
Coup de foudre.
Yes.
So when you love blinds you like that. So what does it take? You know, you became MOF at what age? 26?
I was 26, yes. Yeah. I was working at the Negresco with a person with MOF. You know, when I started the Negresco, I don't even know what.
Now
MOF
that's
means.
In Nice. It's the storied hotel of Nice,
the
right
beautiful
on the boulevard,
hotel, on the Promenade des
Promenade,
Anglais.
Yes.
It's beautiful. It's old. It's pretty much a museum. You sleep in a museum, and the furniture there, if they are Louis the 16, they are from Louis the 16 time. I mean, it's amazing. It's not copy. It's a lot of original. It's only two of the chandeliers that they have into the hotel. Two made in the world, and one of them is there. It's a museum. Mm. So I walk into this hotel, find a job there, talk to Jacques Maximin, who is also an MOF, and
but culinary, not pastry.
Culinary, yes. Yeah. And I was just coming out of the military, and he kind of liked me at the first sight, you know, he liked me. And he told me, he said, if you're serious, if you're good, I keep you. If you're bad, you're out. That was his first word to me. And I start to work there for, I think I worked 8 years. And after a couple of years, he start to talk to me about the MOF and the competition. He said, you know, you have to enter competition. You have to compete. You have to go into this world. It's great. So I start to enter competition, and every time we saw those guys coming with those blue, white, and red color, and to me those guys was, I don't know, at that
you're talking
time,
about the collar on the chef's jacket.
Yes,
and
the,
if you see a French chef with the red, white, and tricolor, red, white, and blue. It's not for the American flag, it's for the French flag. These are the really honored chefs of France. And you're sitting here today with one of them on. So.
And in France, when you do a competition and those guys walk in the room, it's like the ultimate things in the profession. You don't argue with them. They are the pope of the profession. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that because I'm one of them today. I'm telling you what my feeling was at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't think that about myself. But at that time, those guys was like, wow, MOF. And I put that title so high, so unreachable, that I work hard. And still I was thinking, how many years is it going to take me to accomplish that?
So tell us some of the techniques that are at the highest, hardest level. I don't think we even have a concept of what you have to do.
I think repetitive work is what will bring your hands to do things that's going to be something that you don't have to think about. I was talking to Jacques Pepin, and Jacques Pepin was telling me, you're a master when your hands and your brain are pretty much disconnect. Your hands going to do things, but your brain can think about the next step already. Your hands have this kind of automatism, and it's a little bit like in sport. When you see people playing golf, they have that automatism because they do it so many thousands of times. And I think in our profession, you are not born with that. You have to develop skill. You have to train. You have to work on your training. And first have go to a good school, go to a good chef, and learn the good techniques. And then when you know how to do it, teach your hands. And teaching your hands take time. And I think that's very important.
How long did you have to be a pastry chef before you could even think of taking the MOF exam?
If I remember, you cannot enter the competition before 25 or 26. I was just at the limit when I entered.
They so don't, 10 years.
They don't let you enter before that. And it certainly takes 10 years to master techniques. And you know what? I think that you still learn your whole life. You learn about little things. So you have the basics, and the basics have to be very strong. But you keep learning. And I think what pushed me, something has to push people. What pushed me was that unreachable goal of the MOF. To me, that was almost unreachable. So I worked so hard on it. And when I entered the competition, I passed, and I was amazed. And I think that's due to the vision that I had of them, thinking, wow, it's unreachable. So I worked even harder.
What was the hardest technique for you to master?
I think that decoration, sugar, you know, you have to do a centerpiece. It's pretty much a sculpture made out of chocolate and sugar, mostly sugar for the MOF. And sugar is hot. It's kind of some type of caramel that you're going to shape with your hands. At that time, we don't wear any gloves. Ugh. So your hands have to get callous. You know, you burn yourself a lot. And that's, I think that takes years of practice. And I was doing that on the afternoon during the break. You know, in France, when you work in a restaurant, you work 9 to 3. Then you go home for 3 hours. And then you 2.5 to 3 hours. Then you come back at 5:36 p.m. And then you, over there, people eat a little bit later than here. And then you work until, for the pastry chef, certainly 11:30. So they are long days. But to me, on the afternoon, instead of going home, I was, you know, happy that my boss let me take that sugar equipment and train. And everybody was gone, and I was alone in that kitchen, and I was, you know, training and pulling sugar and making things that look like lettuce at the beginning, and eventually they start to look like flowers. So I was so proud of myself.
So tell me, people say there's a difference between a culinary chef and a pastry chef. Do you think they're different personalities? I mean, are they... You know, do you have a proclivity to doing one over another? What's the difference?
I think it's a lot of similarities and some big difference. We all have a passion for what we do. We love to make people happy. We love food, and we are all craftsmen. That's who we are, culinary and the pastry chef, and savory and sweet. Now, the difference are, if you compare that to the doctor world, to me, the chef is more someone who will be at the emergency room. And you know, you have the tickets coming and you have to react to that. In an emergency room, you have people getting hurt. They come and you react to that. The pastry chef is more someone who has to plan in advance. You cannot just do something in 2 minutes. You have to have all those bays and everything ready and the cakes. And I mean, it's so many steps. So, you know, the pastry chef will be maybe the surgeon will take care of the knee or the shoulder, where you need to do to have a plan and do an X-ray and then so on. So the pastry chef has to really plan. If you do a wedding cake starts on a piece of paper, and you draw it, and you talk to the bride, and you look at the color, and you look at the flower, you look at the height, how many people, you know, the size, the shape, and then eventually you do the cake, and that's a lot of steps. So I think that's pretty much the difference between the pastry chef and the chef.
You know, at the school, I notice that the students in the pastry division versus the culinary division come from different walks of life. In the pastry division, because they have to be precise, many came from the medical field. We have a lot of dentists, actually,
yes.
that come and say, I'm finished with dentistry. We want people to love us. We want to be a pastry chef now and cause the cavities, you know. And so you have architects, engineers that really love pastry. And in the culinary, we have, you know, a lot of Wall Street bond traders, high school principals, Navy SEALs, people that like the rough and tumble of, you know, working on the spur of the moment. And I do think that there are these two major personality differences. And pastry kitchens tend to be a lot quieter, don't they?
Yes, and that's, I think, because, you know, the planning. If you talk about an architect working on pastry, they know how to balance a big cake or to balance a big centerpiece. And it makes sense that they are attracted to that because the principles stay the same.
Yeah.
You know, you need to do something that's going to stand up. the dentist, I'm still friend with one of the first students.
Goldfinger.
Oh. I love this name, Goldfinger. I wish that's my name, Goldfinger. Can you imagine? So Bert, and I'm still friend with him, and he's... he worked with me and we did some TV show together. And I asked him, I said, wow, you're so good to do, you know, those little things. And he told me, he said, Jacques, do you know the size of a tooth? We have to carve those things. It's small. He said, actually, you know, pastry are pretty big for me.
Yeah.
So that was amazing that, you know, he can make mold. That guy was making the best mold. Why? Because he molds tooth all the time. So, I love cross profession. I love to use the techniques from another profession into what I do, like the molding from a dentist into making sugar, as an example. A dentist know how to make mold. An architect or an engineer.
Well, we're gonna get into your multi talents because you do cross over lots of different professions. We're gonna take a break here now, and when we come back, we're gonna talk about your American journey.
Today's program has been brought to you by AmeriCraft. AmeriCraft and 360 Cookware are proud sponsors of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. AmeriCraft is an American company, and like Heritage Radio Network, they provide the best. Their 360 Cookware is made of the highest quality ingredients, like United States steel. It is made in the greenest cookware manufacturing plant in the world. AmeriCraft makes great cookware and is focused on improvement. 360 Cookware is their exclusive line. It's a contemporary line of cookware and bakeware intended to let you, the Heritage Radio Network listeners, have a unique cooking experience. Its vapor seal allows food to be cooked in its natural juices, preserving all of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients without added water, oils, or fats. 360 Cookware invites you to learn more about how this process works on their website, www.360cookware.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and my guest today is Mr. Chocolat, Jacques Torres. So, Jacques, we were just talking about, you know, winning the MOF in France and what that meant and how you really learned to be the pastry chef you are. And then you came to the United States. The very first time was to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty. And at that stage, you came to work at the French Culinary Institute with Gaston Le Nôtre. Hélène Chappelle and Jacques Maximin that you were talking about before. And you were cooking for President Ronald Reagan and François Mitterrand, the
yes.
president of France. And you were only here for 3 or 4 days. And I'm so happy that you were at the French Culinary Institute.
Dorothy, I love it so much that I didn't sleep for 4 days, you know.
So what was your first thoughts coming to New York?
I always loved the image whatever I was thinking was America. And when I came, I love it even more. Those big buildings, the life, the electricity. I was scared of it, but I love it. So, you know, I went to Central Park. I visit a lot of places, looking at the Statue of Liberty, being to this very impressive harbor. I think New York was the biggest port in the world at one point, and it's gorgeous when you look at on one side the Verrazano and the statue and downtown Manhattan. It's very humbling in a way to see that big city in front of you. So I did fall in love with New York and with the American way.
And you were working at Negresco.
I was at the Negresco at that time. Yes,
yeah.
I was already MOF. I was MOF for almost a year. When we came, I think that was 87, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, because you got the
yes.
86, the MOF.
Yes.
So how did you get your? I mean, I think you were best known for working at Le Cirque, right? You were there for 10 years, was it?
Yes, almost 12 years.
Almost
12 years. Yes.
And what was that like? I know you first went to California, and then you were working, I think, Ritz-Carlton Group.
Yes, I worked for the Ritz-Carlton Group for 1 year. And then I moved to Le Cirque. That was a great opportunity for me.
And Danielle was the chef.
Danielle was the chef. Sota was his sous chef. Marc Poitevin also was there. We are all, you know, master chef. And I learned something interesting at Le Cirque. I came with the skill of my profession, so I know how to work in pastry. But what I don't know at that time was maybe the relationship between the chef, the customer, and the chef and the press. And this is what I think Sirio is a master on that.
Sirio Maccione, the owner of the circus, Le Cirque.
And this is what I take there. That was amazing to see Sirio talking to the press, the customer coming into the kitchen, talking to us. Then I realized the chef is not just the chef on the back of the kitchen with a dirty jacket. The chef has to be impeccable. The chef has to talk to the customer. The chef has to please people with their food, but also with their personality. And this is what I learned there. I learned getting out of the kitchen. And for 12 years, I work on that. I work on actually be also not just a pastry chef, but also in front, a little bit in front of the house. And
who were some of the people you cooked for?
Oh.
Baked for?
I think I'm going to start with the Pope.
The Pope?
Yes. One day, Sirio asked us to, he said, okay, we're going to do a lunch for the Pope. And the Vatican has a house on 72nd Street between, if I remember, 5th and
Madison.
And on the south side of the streets. And I don't know, that was from the Vatican. And we had to go there 3 days before and scout the location. And then we came back when the Pope was there and we cooked for him. And they asked us to cook pretty fast, to send the dish pretty fast. They say, you know, the Pope doesn't eat at the restaurant often. And if no food is coming back, he's getting up and leave. He says, so have the food coming back fast. So we did serve him pretty fast. And then he meet
this
us.
This is John Paul?
Yes.
Yes, John Paul II. Huh?
And then he meet us in front of the, we went in front of the dining room, and then the door opened and he came out. And then he blessed every chef and give us a rosary. And that was amazing. So that's who I want to mention first, because, you know, after the Pope, what do you do?
Really?
But then after that, you know, the King of Spain, the President of the U.S., President of France, all Hollywood, pretty much all Hollywood stopped by Le Cirque, and financial people. I mean, at that time, that was the restaurant where all the celebrity came. And, and you know, I was fortunate enough to actually take some picture with them and meet people. That was amazing. That was an amazing time.
Why did you leave?
I leave because after doing that for 12 years, I kind of give, I don't know, I will say give my guts. You know, you give everything. But for how long can you give everything and renew yourself? And I was kind of, I decide that I succeed in France, and then I get a name here. I did some television. I get a name in US. The only thing that I didn't do was to run a business. So I'm thinking, wow, maybe that's another page. Let's turn the page again. I turned the page when I left France, and then now I'm going to turn another page, and maybe I'm going to try to be an entrepreneur. And I start that. And that was a...
Is that a typical thing for a chef to want, or is this Jacques Torres?
I don't know if it's typical for a chef. I mean, you almost have to have two side of your brain work. Basically, you want to be an innovative chef. You want to be someone who can taste and work and organize a kitchen and be very innovative and draw on paper what you're going to do and accomplish it. And in another way, you have to be that person who is extremely logical, 1 and 1 equal 2, not 3 or no 1. And you have to be, pretty much good in math. That's I think, where that come from. And I think I have a very good logic. And this is why I heard a phrase. If you have low cost and sell your product at a good price, you will succeed. Okay, that was my rule number one.
So it sounds pretty good.
let's do that. And I start. I build my first location. Again, low cost. Okay.
Did you have to go look for money, find partners?
It's funny. I was training for the marathon, and I passed in Dumbo. Dumbo is located between the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge, on the water. On the Brooklyn side. And it's a beautiful old neighborhood with those warehouses from the time where the ship was bringing coffee and spices. And I fall in love with this neighborhood, those red bricks and the graffiti on the wall. It's very artistic. So I approach the landlord and ask if he has some space. So I find a space and if I remember, 4,000 square foot plus 1,000 square foot basement. And at that time, I don't have the funds to hire a team to build it. So I'm thinking, I'm going to do it. So with a couple of friends, we buy tools. My friend has a truck, who was the most important things. We start every day at 7 a.m. at Home Depot. I can tell you all the prices from Home Depot and where things are. Still today, I know exactly where things are. That's amazing. And we build it. We build the first manufacturer. And
how did you decide you wanted to do chocolate and not have a pastry shop?
It's again that comes from my logical side. I am a pastry chef. I can say I'm an expert in pastry, but pastry, even if pastry has my heart, pastry is relatively difficult to sell retail, because if you do very high end pastry, they are good for one day. They are good actually for a few hours. So they come out of the back at 8, 9 a.m. By 5 p.m., if they are not sold, most of them going to end up giving away, because what can you do with that? It's too old to sell the next day.
Maybe soggy or
yes, and
or stale.
Rent is so expensive in New York. This is certainly one of the most expensive places in the world. So I think about all that, and I'm thinking, chocolates actually, high-end chocolate will have some shelf life. 2 weeks, 3 weeks of shelf life, well protected in a cool environment, you don't trash them the next day. So chocolate makes more sense. And another thing that attracts me to chocolate is not only I love to work with chocolate, but if you look at retail price, with $100, you have to do quite a bit of pastry to reach a $100 bill. And that pastry is going to take certainly 3 feet of space for that amount of money. Chocolate's going to take half foot to have something for $100. So I'm thinking, New York square foot is so expensive. Let's do something a little bit more compact. I will not need all the space to do pastry. I can start, manufacture a little bit smaller. And I love to make chocolates. I have a passion for chocolates. Actually, now it's an obsession. And and I will be able to be a little bit more efficient doing that. So... And I'm thinking, I can always try. So I try. And to my surprise, there was a line in front of that store in Brooklyn at the beginning. And And I was the first chef, and now it's very trendy.
And it's the middle of nowhere. So to have a line, they had to come from everywhere else. It wasn't the neighborhood.
I have no idea where. I was asking people, where you come from? They was coming from all over, and people from Brooklyn was thanking me. I cannot believe that I sell chocolate, they give me money, and they thanks me. And I was, thank you for coming here. And at that time, no chef will leave Manhattan to come to Brooklyn. That was the opposite way. Mm-hmm. You go from Brooklyn and you end up in Manhattan where you're going to compete with those big chefs. Now, 11 years later, 12 years later, it's trendy to leave to Brooklyn and open.
Were there American chocolate shops? Wasn't your competition Godiva and Toucher?
There was no small maker at that time.
Right. You were the first one. So you were a pioneer as well.
A little bit of it. You know, it's very funny because a couple years after I start, the New York Times did a piece and rate chocolate makers. It start to be a little bit more places that sell chocolates. Mm. And I remember that the chocolate bar was first, Maribel was second, La Maison du Chocolat was third, and I was number four. And when I see that article make me smile because I was making the chocolate for the chocolate bar. I was making the chocolate for Maribel. And La Maison du Chocolat was making their own. And yep. I was making the chocolate for myself. So I was one, two, and four. That was pretty funny.
And Maison du Chocolat made their chocolates in France,
They
right?
make their chocolate in France.
So you beat out the French. And you're a very smart businessman. You took the fourth place so you could continue to sell to the first and second.
That's it. So that was very funny. But yes, I opened at the right time. The movie Chocolat was just, coming out or just a year maybe into the screen. So people has that nostalgic image of chocolates. Mm. There was no real really anyone making the chocolates. I was the first one to start from bean all the way to the chocolate bar. Mm. Nobody was doing that in the area at that time. I was fortunate to pick something that
Did you understand the risk you were taking?
I don't think I take any risk in a way. I started this company, if I remember, with $150,000. So that was a part of my retirement that
Amazing.
I put into there. And again, low cost, and try to sell your product at a fair price. And that's exactly what I did. I save money as much as I can. I sleep little. I build.
Who needs business school? You've got it right, Jacques. Okay, we're going to come back. We have to take another break here. We're going to come back and really get some more pearls of wisdom from you.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Jacques Torres, the MOF, former pastry chef of Le Cirque, and Mr. Chocolate himself from Jacques Torres Chocolates. Jacques, how many shops do you have now? Give me the sense of how you've grown over the last, 10,
almost 12 years now.
12 years.
So the first one was in Dumbo, in Brooklyn Dumbo. Mm-hmm. And 3 years later, I opened in downtown Manhattan, 8,000 square foot location plus 2,000 square foot of offices. That was a big move. That was a lose everything or succeed. So I opened that. Fortunately, customer was there for us. Then I opened on the Upper West Side on the 73rd, 74th and Amsterdam Avenue. Mm-hmm. The next one was Chelsea Market. We opened a counter there. And then Rockefeller Center.
Mm.
I also, on the meantime, opened a little ice cream shop in Brooklyn next to my chocolate shop. And lately, yesterday, I opened a pop-up shop on 21st, 22nd Street and 8th Avenue.
What do we? Yesterday, you opened a pop-up shop. Where did this come from?
I don't know. That was a crazy idea. A friend of mine, who is a real estate agent, approached me to rent a store there. and I went to see it. I'm not so hard to open it full time, but I told him, I said, look, rent it to me for 1 month and I take it. And 2 hours later, he came with a contract. So I signed the contract, went into the space, look around and say, oh my God, what did I do again? And then I bring my saw, I bring my all my equipment, I buy some, I went to Home Depot again.
This is last week?
This was last week.
So 10 days ago, you had no notion you were going to open a store.
Almost 5 days ago.
5 days ago. And now the store is in operation?
The store is open. This
is entrepreneurial. Go. So the guy says, I want you to look at this as a regular space. Right.
Yes.
To have a store, and you say pop up, and then you're there with your saw. You didn't get a contractor.
No, I did that because when you do a pop up, you have to minimize your investment into the space because the return has to come in less than a month. So it's very short. I mean, Christmas sales are historically good, but nobody know me in that neighborhood. So the risk have to be, you know, well balanced. So I'm thinking no one in my staff going to build furniture. So I build a bar, I build a counter, I build some shelf. I buy some flooring, and again, Home Depot, 179 square foot. And then I put all those things together, put some paint on the wall, varnish the furniture, hang fabric on the ceiling, buy some Christmas decoration. And everybody was peeking his head into the store. What's coming? What's coming? And chocolates. So last night I was giving chocolate in the street in front of the store. And we have our first sales yesterday.
Okay, so I have to ask you, how much did you spend on the at Home Depot? Like how much did it cost you to outfit this store?
Outfitting the store cost $3,500.
Okay, all of New York, we've got to go look at this store. It's open right now. It's 8th Avenue between
21st, 22nd, and 8th, yes.
Okay, we have to go support this.
It's cute.
This
it's very $3,500.
Everybody who is bitching that New York is too costly to operate in, this is really quite the story. We have to go there and
see
what
adventure.
You did. It's an adventure. I should mention it is the holiday season in December, and so it's a perfect time to have a pop-up there. So what were your sales first day?
First day was almost $400. I mean, you know, the calculation is pretty easy. The store going to cost us with the rent about 10,000. So I need to cover that before the end of the month. It should be fine.
How many cookies do you sell a month?
we make between 6,000 and 8,000 every week. Okay. This is what we do every week. So we sell a lot of cookies. Those cookies are, you know, it's amazing. I try to make a little bit of pastry, but because I sell so much chocolates, my customer was not coming to my place for fresh pastry. So I tried different things, and then I end up thinking, you know, Americans love cookies. What if I try to make the best I can with cookies? So I went to the grocery store. I buy one of those package of Toll House
cookies.
Little piece of chocolates. Mm. I came back to my place. I opened the package. I trash the chocolates. Don't eat that stuff. And then I look on the package, the recipe of the cookies. I don't even know to make the cookies at that time.
This is the master chef from France looking at the back of them.
So I read that recipe in grams. And then I rebuild. I love to do that. I break down a recipe. I rebuild it thinking, you know, making my little calculation there. And I come up with a formula that I like. So I make it, put it in a store. Never change it. Those cookies was voted best cookies in New York by Martha Stewart. She did that on her show. And, you know, people talk about it on the internet, on the Twitter, on Facebook. I mean, they're great. And I just put more butter and a lot of chocolate.
Don't tell me. I just ate half of one before we started the show. I don't want to know how much chocolate and butter and sugar.
That's what I do, you know.
Yeah.
French think that if you put more butter, you make things better. So, you know.
Well, Americans think if you put more bacon, you make things better. So,
different
to
animal.
Each their own. Yeah, different animal, right. So so tell me, what's the you're just a serial entrepreneur. I mean, what do you enjoy more, making the chocolates or being a pastry chef or being a business person? Because you're obviously
that's my
so
problem.
Talented.
That's my problem. I love it all. I love the feeling of coming up with something new. It can be a new chocolate, it can be a new centerpiece, it can be a new hollow figure for Christmas. Mm. And it can be a new store. The feeling of of smelling, still smelling the varnish a little bit. Mm. And then you open the store and you start to pack the store with chocolates, and you open the door and you start talking to people. That feeling of I accomplished something, I think that's all the same feeling. I accomplished something with my hands. I'm a craftsman, and this is what I love to do. I love to make things with my hands. And it can be a store, it can be a piece of chocolate, it can be a wedding cake. It can be anything. I love to create, I love to make, I'm a maker. Running the company is certainly secondary, even if it's extremely important to run your company the right way. Otherwise, no company, no making. So one feed the other. But to me, the making is certainly what drives me.
The making of the product and the excitement.
The product, or making a store, or making a piece of furniture, or making something with my hands.
If you're going to step outside of chocolate and pastry, what would you do?
I don't know what I will do. I will have to think about it. Certainly fishing.
I tell people, you live on a boat in New York Harbor in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty. So you know,
only a plane will do what a boat do, meaning you can turn right, you can turn left, you can go straight. In a car, on a motorcycle, don't do that. But on a boat, you have some freedom. You know, I mean, you need water under yourself. But, you know, it's a lot of water out there. And I love the boat, and I love fishing. I love it's relaxing to me, you know, the be on the water. I think I'm grounded to the water. The stress go away. You can breathe. You can see the elements. You can see the sky. And I love that. I just love the feeling of the boat. So
there are a lot of large reason we do these shows is because there are a lot of young aspiring chefs out there. And they listen to this to learn something from all the great chefs we interview. If you have words of wisdom to say to someone who wants to be the next Jacques Torres, what is it that what are the elements that you think made you who you are today?
I think one of the most important things to me is stay yourself. You have to stay. You have to be who you are. I am a guy who loves the water, live a pretty simple life. Ride a bicycle, you know, this is who I am, but also have a passion. Passion is very important in life. You have to have a passion and a goal, because otherwise life go with, you need to accomplish things because that make you, or that at least make me feel good to accomplish certain things, whatever it is, to have some accomplishment in your life. And also the passion for what you do. And one thing that I want to mention that's maybe the most important, anything is possible. That's what I come up now after those years, after what I did. I did it maybe an uncommon way of doing it, and I might not recommend the way that I did it. I take risk, and maybe it's too much, but anything is possible. Be yourself, love what you do, and have faith, because anything is possible. I really believe that today.
What about discipline?
It takes hard work. It definitely takes hard work. Don't get up at noon. Get up in the morning. And yes, you have to have some discipline into what you do. Learn your base. The basics are the most important in our profession. You cannot build anything on weak foundation. So learn your basics. You know, come to the school. You will work at a school with the best chef in the world.
I didn't mean this to turn into
no, but,
a commercial.
But you know what?
But what
Dorothy,
about
it,
ego?
It is important.
What about, yeah, well, discipline, and you can learn that in a day.
Yeah.
But what about ego, too? Like, how you have to believe in yourself.
You have
but,
to believe
but
in yourself.
What does that mean?
Don't have too much ego. If you have too much ego, people will not like you. I think that's the key. I mean, believe in yourself, but don't have too much ego. We have to have a little bit of ego. We know what we do. We are good at what we do. We have to have a certain ego. But it cannot be overboard. After all we do is food. We play with food. We are not Da Vinci. We are not builder. We work with food. We make people happy. It's very, I don't know how you say that, ephemeral. Something that
ephemeral.
Go away very fast. So, you know, it's no reason to have a huge ego.
I think one of the great things that makes your product so successful, and you personally so successful, is your joie de vivre. You have a tremendous love of life, and it just exudes from you. You can't walk in a room without lighting it up and making, without your chocolates. He always shows up with bags and bags of chocolates. Okay, my last question for you. What's your favorite chocolate that you created?
I don't know. You know, to me, chocolate my business is something where we do so many things. From the hot chocolate, I went to spend a week in Oaxaca with people who live there to learn about the spice for my hot chocolates. But, you know, learning to make a good chocolate from exceptional cacao beans, to make a box of chocolates, I don't know which chocolate I will be the most proud of. To me, it's a line of products. And I'm telling you, if one of those products, one day I eat it and I don't find it good, I will stop it. I will replace it with something else. I will not accept to sell something that I don't like.
And you mentioned something to me right before we started. You're buying a plantation?
Oh, I'm investing into a plantation in Mexico. It's a little valley where it's the person who run that area, that plantation, have a plantation already, and they're going to manage it. So I'm investing money to have my own cocoa tree. And
why?
I think it's a way of starting from the beginning all the way to the end. It's a place where I can go, where I can see my cacao tree. I don't know. It's not a money-making things. You know, sometimes craftsmen are pretty difficult to understand. We do things because we love to do certain things. We don't always do things for money. Being a craftsman is a way of life. Being a craftsman is not a way of making a lot of money. Even if sometimes, you know, you can have a pretty good living, it's a way of life. My dad was a carpenter, and he was not a carpenter from 9 to 5. He was a carpenter all his life. In vacation, he will stop in front of a door and take his pad of paper and draw the door. That was in his blood, and I think I'm a craftsman. And I take decisions sometimes that doesn't always make sense. Maybe it will eventually, but having my own tree, learn about that, fermenting my own cacao bean, drying them, bring them to New York, make my own chocolates, at least will make me happy.
Jacques, you make me happy. Thanks for being here today. I want to thank everyone. And we will see you next time on Chef Story.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.